The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, I'm joined by Dr. David Shulman, and our topic is sleep. Yeah, what's normal and what are the most common sleep problems and what can you do if you're struggling to get a good night's sleep? Dr. Shulman is a professor of medicine in the Division of Pulmonary, Allergy, Critical Care, and Sleep Medicine at Emory University, where he has served on faculty for 19 years. He's the director of the Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine Fellowship Training Program and also director of Emory School of Medicine's Foundations of Medicine phase, which comprises the first 18 months of education for our medical students. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So, David, you know, sleep is such a fascinating topic. And from my experience in my practice, so many people today are struggling with getting a good night's sleep. So I want to start by asking you, from your perspective, what are the most common sleep problems that you encounter when, we refer people to you as a sleep specialist?
So I would divide the most common sleep problems into three main buckets. Now there are other more specific, more subtle things, but there are three large categories that I think probably represent 80 to 90% of the people that I see in my clinic. And so the first bucket is people who have difficulty either falling or staying asleep. People will call this insomnia, but insomnia means different things to different people. So I have difficulty falling asleep, or I awaken in the middle of the night, and once I'm awake, I have difficulty getting back to sleep. That's bucket one. Bucket two are people who seem to get adequate sleep, but really say that they have a lot of daytime sleepiness despite this. Now, this is a tough category because, as we know, there are a lot of things that can cause fatigue. And so there are sleep problems that fit into this category, but there are many other things that also fit into causes of fatigue, even with what's perceived to be a normal night's sleep. And probably the third category I see are people who feel fine and they feel like they sleep okay and they have good daytime energy level, but they're being told about snoring or irregularities in their breathing at night. And so they come in because other people are concerned about them. I think those are the three big categories of patients that represent most of the folks I see.
But you just summarized what I see as well. So I would agree then that that's about 80 to 90%. So the first bucket, I think, is probably the most challenging for a lot of my patients. It's the falling asleep and more so the staying asleep. So, a lot of people, get up at 2 or 3 in the morning and just struggle. And by the time they get back to sleep, their alarm clock goes off an hour later, and then they're continually sleep deprived. So let's dive into that bucket. How do you even begin approaching that?
So the chronicity of the problem certainly is one of the things I ask about. So how long has this been going on? And more importantly, maybe how frequently does it occur? So if you look at normal healthy people, the average normal healthy person will have 1 or 2 nights of insomnia, difficulty falling asleep per month. And that's probably not abnormal. Why? Because life is stressful. We have social stresses, we have financial stresses, we have work-related stresses. And part of falling asleep is to be relaxed. When we're stressed out by something, it's hard to relax. So if you have insomnia after you've gotten bad news or there's a big deadline coming up, that's not abnormal. Now, if it goes on for long periods of time, it can lead to impairment. But to me, that's a normal reaction to a stressful situation. And it probably doesn't surprise anybody either on this podcast or listening to it if I ask you which night of the week would you guess most people report insomnia? If you look at the 7 nights, Sunday through Saturday, what is the most common night that people report insomnia? It's
Sunday.
Overwhelmingly Sunday. Overwhelmingly Sunday.
Not even close. Exactly.
Right? And then again, that's why? Because we've had a nice relaxing weekend. Oh, we got to get up. Maybe we slept a little later. Oh, we got to get up early for work the next day. So Sunday night insomnia is fairly common. Stress-related insomnia is common. So getting to the frequency of the insomnia and the duration is one of the first things, right? Let's say you had a relative die, somebody you were close to, a friend die. insomnia is a normal reaction to that, right? And that may last a week or a couple of weeks. And we'll talk about behaviors that we can do to try to mitigate that. But to me, that's a normal reaction to an abnormal stress. So that's one of the things, first things, is there something that caused this? And is there something that we can do to alleviate that stress? Or do we think that's going to go away with time, as many stressful things do? So once we've determined, well, it doesn't seem to be a reaction to a normal stimulus, then we say, well, is there a cause to it? So what keeps you awake? Environment is a common cause, right? People sleep better when it's cool and dark. That probably doesn't surprise folks. But the number of people who tend to leave the TV on, which is noise, minor issue, light, more major issue. People who have noisy neighbors, people who to save money, particularly in the summer, turn the air conditioning up. Again, I'm not opposed to saving money. I'm all about that. But people sleep worse in warm weather, right? Those film noirs that we, from the 40s and 30s when people, you know, the dark night, sleepless night in the summer, like that's a common thing. People don't sleep well when it's hot. So cooling the room is often helpful. Wearing earplugs, particularly as we get older, minimal noises that would have never kept us awake when we were younger can disrupt sleep. You know, it's not loud, it's not bothering you. You might be surprised. And oftentimes a $2 pair of phone earplugs can make a marked improvement. So check out the environment. Is there anything in the environment which might be contributing to sleep disruption, and how can that be eliminated or can at least minimize its impact on the person who's complaining of sleeplessness? If it's not the environment, is there something the person is doing? Are they exercising or doing work right up till bedtime? Are they using their tablets or phones? This is one of the most common things. Our peripheral brains, these phones and tablets that we tend to use even right up to bedtime, unless we program them correctly, the light coming off of these things can alert us. Fortunately, most of the major operating systems now have programs that you can use to turn on a nightlight mode where it will change the coloration of the screen. So if you are using screens before bedtime and you're not already using that nightlight mode, please Google it, look it up, figure out how to turn it on, contact one of us, we'll help you figure it out. It's not hard, but it can do a lot to helping people not be alerted right before bedtime. Even if they are using light mode, if they're doing work right before bedtime and work is stressful, like separating that by 30 minutes, 45 minutes, some downtime to relax, take it easy. That can be helpful. Are they drinking coffee? Now there's a misconception that if you drink coffee, you know, even in the afternoon, it's not gonna be a problem, but coffee lasts in the system for 10 to 12 hours. So if you're complaining of insomnia at the beginning of the night, I'm gonna really hound you to stop taking coffee afternoon. Like breakfast, I'm not gonna get on you about, but anything afternoon, we're really gonna keep an eye on. And then there are other sources of caffeine besides coffee. People drink sweet tea, they drink sodas. Chocolate is a caffeine, has caffeine in it, not maybe a lot, but if you're eating a chocolate for dessert, that can contribute to sleep disruption. What other substances? Cigarettes. Cigarettes are not gonna help calm you down. You really wanna avoid cigarettes, ideally for at least 2 to 3 hours before bedtime. Some people would say more. Alcohol. Alcohol is great at helping you fall asleep, but it's terrible at helping you stay asleep. So if you're having a nightcap or alcohol, you know, within a couple of hours of dinner, it may actually help you fall asleep, but it will make your sleep later in the night worse. So check out what kinds of things that people are using right before bed. Once I've ruled all of that out, I'll then turn to physical symptoms. Are there specific things that you feel that keep you awake, right? So there are people with heart problems or lung problems who may, when they lie down, get short of breath. That's not particularly a sleep-related problem, but it can cause insomnia. And sometimes probing for those contributors. What physical symptoms do you have that might be getting in your way? Are there musculoskeletal pains when you lie on your hips? Do you have a bad muscle or a bad joint that causes pain and causes you to toss and turn a lot? One of the more common complaints that I deal with in my clinic that is a physical complaint that causes people to have difficulty falling asleep is something called restless leg syndrome, which is typically something that starts about 30, maybe 45 minutes before bedtime and will last for hours after bedtime sometimes. And it's a very hard to explain restlessness that generally occurs in the legs, can occur in the arms also, but most prominently in the legs. And people really can't say it's painful. They just say it almost feels like a creeping and crawling in the legs, and it only gets better if you move around. And if you move around, it gets better. And then when you try to fall asleep again, it gets worse. So, there are a lot of different things that can contribute to insomnia. And one of my main jobs, and when somebody comes in with complaints of insomnia, is to subcategorize them into one of these large buckets.
Yeah, that is super helpful and a great approach. Now, once you have ruled out, you know, the environment and the physical symptoms, you know, one thing that I hear a lot is that when people get up in the middle of the night, they can't shut off their thoughts. Like, it's just they're planning their day, they're thinking what they should have done, they remember all kinds of things, and it's just become the time where they do their best thinking. How do you work through that?
So this is a not uncommon complaint. I wake up overnight, and if I don't turn over and go right to sleep right away, that my mind gets, often you'll hear mind racing. My mind starts racing and I can't shut it off. And so again, not uncommon. One of the biggest mistakes I think that people make is they lay in bed in the dark and hope it's gonna get better. I think it's fine to try that for 15 or 20 minutes. I think if more than 15 or 20 minutes passes once you've awakened in the middle of the night and you cannot get back to sleep, as weird as it is, it's actually helpful to get out of bed and take a break. I liken it to approaching a math problem differently. Sometimes you're working on a math problem or any problem and you're puzzled, you can't get it. Sometimes stepping away, taking a little break, walking around, coming back and approaching it with a new view makes things better. Sleep in the middle of the night is not uncommonly like that. So I'll say to folks, take 20, maybe 30, no more than 30 minutes. And if you can't get back to sleep in that first 30 minutes after awakening, do me a favor and take a break. Now, I don't want it to be a 2-hour break. And I don't want it to be a break where you go and start exercising or you go drink coffee or you turn on the TV. I'd rather be a break where you sit in a chair, maybe listen to music. Maybe you grab a journal and start journaling. That's actually pretty helpful for people who have stresses about work the next day. Sometimes taking out an empty piece of paper and writing down your thoughts so that you can pick them up in the morning is really, it's just sort of, it's a way of uploading the information and the stress from your head onto paper, and that can often help. And after a 20 or 30 minute break doing puzzles or journaling or listening to music, coming back to bed and trying again is my next step. And that process can repeat. If you, again, for 20 or 30 minutes can't fall asleep, going through that cycle again can be helpful. But lying in bed for, you know, 45, 60, 90, 120 minutes at a time, yelling at yourself to fall asleep is not helpful. And in fact, what probably happens, and this will sound familiar to some listeners of the podcast, is you look at the clock and you say, oh, it's 3 a.m. Man, if I don't fall asleep right now, I'm going to be a mess tomorrow. And then you turn over, now it's 3:30. You're like, wow, it's really going to be bad. I really need to fall asleep. Guess what's not helpful to your falling asleep? Adding more stress and trying to force yourself to sleep. Sleep doesn't come more easily if you're trying to force yourself to do it. You have to kind of let go. And the greater you try to stress the importance of sleep to your body, I think the less likely you're actually to fall asleep.
That's such great advice. And you know, I want to circle back. You had mentioned earlier that as people get older, even minimal noise can awaken them. And so what are normal changes that can happen as people get older?
So it will surprise no one, including again us and probably most listeners, that America is a very sleep-deprived country. There's a misconception about how much sleep is needed and recommended. And so there's a great website you can go to called, it's the National Sleep Foundation's website. It's sleepfoundation.org. They have a lot of great information. But if you look there, what is recommended for adults, adults meaning people from 18 to 64, they are recommending a normal range of 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Now, the average American, or at least half of Americans, are getting less than that. And there are many people who get by on 6. And they'll say, oh, I get by fine on 6. And the reality is they do get by, but I don't think they get by fine. So one of the first things I'll deal with if somebody's, you know, saying, oh, I'm fatigued during the day, is if they're sleeping 6 hours a night, we're really going to try to ramp that up to 7, because I do think 7 is normal. What happens once you get older than 60, 65 is very interesting. Again, let's talk about a misconception. There's a misconception out there that older adults need less sleep. That's actually not true. But what is true about older adults, again, we're talking about people over the age of 65, is their sleep is more disrupted. Because of the reasons we talked about, because they are more sensitive to light and sound, that brick wall that protects us from light and sound when we're kids. And you know, those of us who are parents, we know that we've seen our kids sleep, and you can walk in the room with a drum and they are not gonna wake up. But that isn't the case for adults. And for older people, even walking in the room can wake them up. So more sleep disruption, the technical name is sleep fragmentation, is normal in older adults. So an older adult may say, hey, look, I wake up 2 times overnight. you know, I go pee, when I go back to sleep. Is that a problem? If you're 70, the answer to that question is probably not, unless it's causing you to be sleepy during the day. That's probably not grossly abnormal. And the frequency of nighttime awakenings probably increases as the age goes up. It's wonderful that we're living longer than ever, but there are some normal changes with aging that we're going to see that we have to help people adjust to. The other thing that happens as we get older is some people tend to move towards what we call biphasic sleep. And what that means is, instead of getting an 8 hour block at night, they may not be able to get 8 hours of night. They may only get 6 or 6.5 or even 7 hours at night, but a lot of them will catch up with daytime naps. If they're not actively working, one of the lovely things to do, one of the wonderful blessings that we are gifted with as human beings, is falling asleep after lunch is surprisingly easy, particularly if we're a little sleep deprived. And so for a lot of my older patients who just can't put together 8 hours of sleep during the day, it's going to sound weird, I will prescribe them a 30, 60 minute nap after lunch, or more if the less. There's nothing wrong with a nap after lunch as long as it's not impairing their ability to do things. And again, fortunately, most of my patients who fit in this category have retired or have more flexible part-time work hours, and they can arrange a nap after lunch. So again, helping some of my older patients understand what is normal and abnormal is one of the duties of a sleep physician.
And when you use the term older adults start to feel sleep disruption, so I almost hesitate to ask what age you consider older.
So I think that the sleep disruption tends to be more pronounced over the age of 65.
Okay.
Now, that said, you know, people in their 40s and 50s may wake once overnight. Postmenopausal women, for example, as they're going through the onset of menopause, sleep disruption is unfortunately fairly common because of sweats and flashes and things like that. So again, frequent disruption in sleep is fairly uncommon under the age of 40, but once you cross 40, and certainly once you get to 65, it does become more frequent.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you mentioned that you prescribe naps, because there's so many, questions around what's a good sleep pattern. And you know, the question comes up, you know, are naps good or bad? And it seems like you are in favor of naps when they don't disrupt the nighttime sleep. Is that correct?
Right. So it depends on the goal, right? A lot of this is, what does the patient want? What is the person sitting in front of me in clinic? What is their chief complaint? And I have patients who will come in and say, my spouse doesn't like that I take a nap every day. And I'm like, okay, well, what do you think? And they're like, well, actually, I don't mind. Like, to me, it's fine. I get 6 hours at night, an hour during the day. Then the best thing to do is to just deal with it. I mean, there are pharmacologic ways that we can try to overcome your intrinsic sleep pattern, but I'm not sure I want people on drugs the rest of their life to overcome something that really they don't perceive to be a problem. We see something similar in there. You know, there are night owls and morning larks, right? Even though the classic teaching is, well, people should sleep from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., we know fully well that there are people who really prefer to stay up later, either 1 or 2 a.m. and sleep till 9 or 10 if they can. And there are actually people who would like to fall asleep at 8 or 9 and wake up at 4 or 5. And honestly, there's nothing wrong with any of that. Some of that is normal physiologic changes. So when we're young, we tend to be night owls. As we get older, we tend to be early birds in the morning. You know, I have found, I'm approaching 50 now, I have found I can't sleep in anymore. Like, it's rare for me to sleep past 7 in the morning. That's heartbreaking, because I remember as a teenager, and many of you may remember also, like, you could sleep till 10 or 11 o'clock or noon. My teenagers do sleep until 11 o'clock or noon some days if I don't arouse them. But most adults cannot do that. That's not a disease. That's a normal part of getting older. And while there are ways we can try to overcome that, I hate the idea of putting people on, you know, drugs or behavioral things to overcome what's a normal physiologic change. It's better to teach them about the change and help them adapt to it.
Yeah. And, and I love talking about misconceptions and myths, because there's so many out there. Another one is, you know, so there are people, you know, you touched on some people getting less than sleep, 6 hours or even just 6 hours. If a person says, no, I just don't need sleep, I've always only slept, you know, 5 or 6, and I'm not tired, and you know, it works for me. What do you think about that?
So I will make a statement, and then I will make a caveat. The overwhelming majority of people who sleep less than 6 hours and say they are fine are not fine. Chronic sleeplessness is actually not dissimilar to chronic drunkenness, right? We've all seen movies, or maybe we have friends, hopefully not, who drink more alcohol than they should. And somebody who's really impaired with alcohol doesn't realize that they're impaired. They just, you know, they think they're fine to drive. That's why, I mean, that's why it's so dangerous, because not only does it impair your ability to do things, it also impairs your recognition of that impairment. You just don't realize how poor you are, how poorly performing you are. Chronic sleeplessness is like that. So there are a lot of people who will say, oh, I get by on 5 or 5.5 hours of sleep a night. And when you actually measure them objectively, no, they don't. They are performing at a significantly worse level than they would if they got 6.5 or 7 hours of sleep. Now, trying to negotiate that with them is a challenge, because they'll say, well, wait a minute, I'm losing an extra hour if I get an extra hour of sleep a day. And you try to bargain. You say, well, yeah, but you'll be more efficient in the other hours. And that's not always an easy negotiation. One of them, you know, the challenges of Americans, and maybe this is a worldwide, but I can only speak to practice in this country, is that we are willing to burn the candle at both ends and sacrifice because we're dealing with the here and now. It helps us get promoted at work. It helps us make more money. It helps us meet deadlines. So what if I get one less hour of sleep a night? And it's hard to demonstrate that there are some chronic health problems associated with that sleep impairment. That's, you know, investing now for a distant payoff is something Americans don't do particularly well. Now, here's the caveat. There are a very, very small percentage of people who can get by on 6 hours a night. There are genetic differences that make some people more resistant to the effects of sleep deprivation. And so whether they get 6 or 7 or 8 hours, they do just fine. Now, once you get below 6 hours, that's not clear. So if somebody says, oh, I get 4 hours and I do fine, I'm going to call BS on that. But there are a small percentage of people who seem to get by on 6 without impairment. It's just way fewer than the people who think they do okay on 6 hours.
No, I'm so glad you clarified, because that seems to come up a lot from people who are chronically sleep deprived, and I guess just used to being chronically sleep deprived and think that they're fine. Another, you know, myth slash question that comes up frequently is people who don't sleep well or enough during the week, but then make up for it on the weekend. Kind of the weekend warrior version of sleep. So the damaging effects of not getting enough sleep, have they compensated, or is that not going to physiologically let your body kind of recover?
So I think of sleep as, and certainly sleep deprivation, as taking a loan out from the bank. Right? You can take a loan out Monday through, or Sunday through Thursday a night, as long as you pay it back on Friday and Saturday. And there are probably no chronic ill effects of that. Now, short term, you may be more tired on Monday through Friday than you will be on the weekends. But from a chronic standpoint, I think that's okay, as long as you're willing to live with the short term repercussions of fatigue while you're at work.
So when you say sleep bank, so literally, like, if let's say you got 6 hours each of the 5 weekdays, and on that you're have a deficit of 5 hours, then Friday and Saturday, you know, maybe getting 2 to 3 hours more each night is what you mean by breaking even.
Absolutely. Right. As long as you're willing to live with the short-term effects of being tired during the week, as long as you pay it back on the weekends, you're okay. And let's actually spin it the other way. So let's say that for whatever reason, you know that you're going into a stressful time at work. You know that for the next 4 to 5 days to 2 weeks, that you're going to really be sleep deprived, because you're going to be pulling, you know, burning the midnight oil. One of the things you can do is actually pay it off in advance. So avoid going into what you know to be a stressful period with sleep debt. So if you can say, I know the next week's going to be bad, so I'm going to make sure I get 7 to 7.5 hours a night every night this week to start storing up that, or to avoid at least going in deprived. Like, that's a huge thing. Because again, most Americans are sleep deprived every day. So if you can store up in advance of a coming winter, that's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm. And that's really good advice, especially I think around maybe like a daylight savings. You can even anticipate certain times or periods where you know that you may not get enough sleep for a few nights. And I also want to get back to another, you know, misconception slash myth. And we started talking about it, you know, in the scenario of people that get up, say, at 2 o'clock and they see their alarm clock and they have trouble going back to sleep. So like you said, if it happens after 20 minutes, you get out of bed and try and get back to sleep. But I have some patients who now have done this for so long that they every night, you know, at 2:42, they wake up and it's consistently the same time on the alarm clock and they are up exactly at that time. How much of that sleep pattern is habit? Like, you know, or how much of sleep is habit and it's just reframing a habit as opposed to sleep architecture?
So that's a great question. Let's tackle it. So let's say a patient comes in to see me with that report. They say, you know, doc, every day I wake up at 2 a.m, I'm awake for an hour, I go do this and that, I come back to sleep and I sleep for another 3 hours. My first question is, does that work for you? Are you okay? Are you functional during the day? Are you tired? If they're okay with it, then I really have to think, how aggressively do I want to make changes to their behavior? Because they're doing, they've adapted. Is it weird? Maybe a little, but if it's not causing problems, I'm not sure I'm going to mess with it. Now, the next question is, what wakes them up? So I'll ask those same questions that we talked about in insomnia a little while ago. Is there anything in the environment that might awaken? Is there a partner who's coming in from work at a late, you know, does a second shift at work and comes in late? Are there physiologic things that cause you? So now I'll get back into the snoring question, right? Sometimes people with snoring and sleep apnea, which we can get into if you want, like these folks will awaken overnight and they may not even know why they awaken, but when they ask around, oh yeah, you know, you snore really loudly at night. So if I can find a cause, either internal or external, for their awakening, I'll go after that. I mentioned alcohol earlier. Let me revisit that real quick, right? Somebody who wakes up at 2 a.m. after 3 or 4 hours of sleep, one of the more common causes is they have a nightcap right before bed to help them fall asleep. And as I said, alcohol is great at helping you falling asleep and terrible at keeping you asleep. So to me, that's a very typical pattern for alcohol. Some of the things I'll delve into are mood disorders. Commonly, people with depression and anxiety will have early morning awakenings. Often they will have difficulty getting back to sleep and they won't even get back after an hour. So if I do, in my conversation with the patient, I do sense the possibility of depression or anxiety, I'll do a more formal screen for those things because treatment for underlying mood disorders, depression and anxiety, can make insomnia better. I get a lot of questions about sleeping pills, and not just for this pattern, but even for beginning of the night insomnia. Let me give you my take on sleeping pills, and it may be unpopular. Certainly, I know it's unpopular amongst some patients. I think most sleeping pills should not be given for more than a month, and they should be used for reactionary depression. What I mean by reactive depression, what I mean by that? I had a loved one die. I got fired from my job. I had some major stress. You're gonna have insomnia, that's normal. I have no problem helping people, once we've discussed the basic behavioral techniques, I have no problem helping people through acute periods of insomnia. But the reality is most of these insomnia medications, most of the prescription medications become less effective over time and require dose escalation over time and have side effects when used chronically. And so I say to my patient, if I'm going to give them, I won't mention any brand names, if I'm going to give them a prescription medication for insomnia, I will say to them up front, I really want you off of this after a month. Now, are there exceptions? Sure. If somebody's using it one or two nights a week, I'll let them go longer because I don't think it's not as likely to be, at least from a physiologic standpoint, habit forming. It may be psychologically habit forming, but it's not physiologically habit forming. So if I can limit somebody to one or two pills of medication X a week, I'm a little more comfortable going longer on that. But it is not infrequent for me to see people who've been on medication X for months, if not years, and it's no longer working, and they want to know what we can do for them. And in those instances, I really wish that we could go back on time. And after that first month, we say, you know what? We really need to tackle your insomnia using behavioral techniques. One of the more common techniques, and I won't do a deep dive on it, we can talk a little bit about it if you want, but there are, we can talk for hours about this, something called cognitive behavioral therapy. And so if you're somebody listening to this podcast who's suffering from insomnia and it's been going on for more than a month, I would encourage you to Google the term cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. There are psychologists who practice this. It is an incredibly effective technique. In the long term, it is actually more effective than medication, but it requires people to do stuff. It's like exercising or losing weight. It is, we know that exercising to lose weight or changing your diet to lose weight will help, but it's hard to do. Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia will beat every medication out there in terms of its effectiveness over time, but it requires a commitment. And some people can and some people can't give that.
And just real briefly, you know, there is a lot of interest in cognitive behavioral therapy, and I know it's a very large topic, but can you give a broad overview of what that entails?
So we already talked about one component of it. So what cognitive behavioral therapy is, the idea is that there are either things that you are thinking or doing, cognitive thinking, behavioral doing, that are making the insomnia continue. And so cognitive behavioral therapy is about looking at the things that you think and the things that you do and trying to replace some of the less effective behaviors and thoughts with more effective behaviors and thoughts. So we've already talked about one component of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is not staying in bed for long periods of time when you can't sleep, right? Because again, your mind gets racing. So we have to replace that. So we override that behavior that you've been doing for a long time with this new behavior. And again, it's counterintuitive because what people will say is, well, Dave, if I get up, I definitely won't be sleeping. And I have to counter, you know, Jim or whatever the patient's name is, you're not sleeping anyway. So I hear what you're saying, but I need you to just trust me on this. We got to break the cycle. So that's a component of cognitive behavioral therapy. But there are a lot of different arms. For some people, it's muscle relaxation. It's dedicated physical exercise. It's not jogging, but just concentrating on certain groups of muscles. For some people, it's yoga or imagery therapy, where you envision yourself in certain locations. For some people, it's journaling and documenting what's on your mind for a little bit of time before you go to bed. There's a wide variety of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's why I say, you know, Google it. We could talk about it for hours, but different forms of CBT will work for different people. And so trying to do it on your own can be effective, but honestly, doing it under the auspices of a trained health professional, either a physician or a psychologist, is often more effective.
And, you know, I'm also thinking that, you know, you mentioned insomnia can be a normal response for not getting enough sleep to an abnormal stress, i.e. you may have just lost your job or if you're grieving. But then there's, you know, this bucket of like chronic stress that a lot of people deal with that's not finite with no end in sight. It's just life is stressful. And then even if it's a normal response to stress, it can't be normal long-term, right?
So yes, if you're under chronic stress, ideally we try to find ways to minimize that stress, right? Some people hate their jobs. And honestly, I've had conversations with patients. They're really unhappy at their job. Are there alternatives out there? Now, sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't. Depends on what the economy is doing. But what I do, I would say at least a third, if not half of what I do for my patients with insomnia, chronic insomnia, as you're suggesting here, Sharon, is honestly, it's kind of like psychotherapy. Talk to me a little bit about what's stressing you out. And I'm a big fan of therapy. I know that that's a very polarizing, you know, a recommendation, because some people are huge fans of therapy and some people are just put off by the idea of it. But psychotherapy can be an incredibly effective way of helping people deal with chronic stress. If there's no way to eliminate the stress, try to figure out how do we help you normalize it? Because your response to the stress is exactly what we expect. It's not surprising that you have insomnia. That's not a disease. That's a normal reaction to an abnormal stimulus. How can we, psychotherapy, physician, whatever, help you come up with other ways of adapting to it? So that's a pretty good chunk of what we do. Now, there are, even in the context of people who have abnormal stress and have insomnia, there are often things people can do better, right? A regular bedtime routine is a big deal. So do you go to bed around the same time every night? Do you try to wake up at the same time every day? If one of your big problems is insomnia at the beginning of the night, do you try to minimize naps during the day? Because as you pointed out very nicely earlier, any nap you get during the day, while it'll make you feel better after the nap, is likely to contribute to a little bit of sleep onset insomnia the following night. So just be aware of that. What are other bedtime things that you can do to help your body fall asleep? So we talked about smoking and alcohol. We talked about caffeine. Sometimes a hot shower can be helpful, a hot shower, a hot bath. Now, most people, at least in America, bathe in the morning or shower in the morning. It's unusual for us to bathe or shower at night. And you may respond and say, well, Dave, you said earlier that hot weather is bad. Hot weather makes it harder to fall asleep. How would a hot shower help? And here's the answer. When you come out of a hot shower, so your body's response to a hot shower is your blood vessels in your fingers and toes and in many parts, they dilate. Okay, they dilate. And so when you get out of the hot shower, these dilated blood vessels will actually rapidly lose heat. So right after you come out of the shower, it's actually pretty effective at cooling the body, as weird as it sounds. And so if you can get a hot shower, hot bath before bedtime, that's actually a pretty helpful way of helping people fall asleep. Now, there are some, if you look on the internet, you'll find a lot of other natural remedies that you can do. And honestly, these are probably harmless and maybe helpful. I have recommended my patients try small amounts of meat, no more than an ounce or two of usually ham or turkey. That can help some people. There's tryptophan in there that can be helpful. Hard cheeses, also limiting it to an ounce or so, can be helpful. Avoid carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are not your friends close to bedtime. The blood sugar swings both up, even if you don't have diabetes, the blood sugar swings around bedtime can be disruptive. So go with proteins or cheeses as a way of helping people fall asleep. And then one of the things I've also tried, it's hard to say it's evidence-based, but again, relatively harmless. There are a lot of fans of this thing called tart cherry juice. And so you'd have to Google this. It's not easy to find. You can't just get it at your local grocery store. You have to buy it online. It's not cheap. But some people swear by tart cherry juice. And I've said to folks, look, harmless to try. And I'd say about probably a quarter of my patients think it helps. You know, with no harm, I'm willing to give it a try.
That's a really interesting avenue because, you know, you mentioned, you know, no prescription drugs ideally more than a month, but I'm sure you get asked this a lot. Are there like natural supplements, you know, things over the counter that are not addictive and safe that people can do?
So a lot of people will take Benadryl, right? Benadryl is something we all took probably as kids. Our parents gave it to us when we, you know, for multiple reasons, for allergies. It's effective for allergies. But one of the common side effects of Benadryl is sleepiness. And so what many people will do is they'll say, well, I know this works for sleepiness. It's over the counter. How bad can it be? And they'll take it. It's funny because I saw a patient probably about 5 or 7 years ago. And I remember very distinctly, she came in and said, I don't have any problems, but I take a Benadryl every night to sleep. Is that bad? Now, she was probably in her 40s. And I said, let me look into it. And I did my best. And as far as I could tell, I'd say, look, I don't love the idea, but I don't think at your age it's particularly harmful. There are two potential downsides to taking something like Benadryl. The generic name is diphenhydramine. So if you look on a lot of your cold remedies that cause you to fall asleep will have diphenhydramine in it. That's just the fancy name for Benadryl. I see only two real problems. One is, I don't think in and of itself it's habit forming because it doesn't last in your bloodstream long. It's gone by the morning. But again, I think from a psychological standpoint, it is habit forming. So you may convince yourself psychologically that you cannot fall asleep without it, and thus you become psychologically dependent on it. Because you'll worry if you don't take it, oh, I'll never sleep tonight. And that, of course, is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if you're worried about your sleep, like we talked about earlier, it becomes harder to fall asleep. The other problem, and Sharon, you can probably speak more to this than I can, is that as you get older, maybe past 70 or 75, Benadryl is not as safe a medication. And I know folks have significant, it may be more common in men than women. I feel like I've seen it more in men than women, but like urinary retention for some of my patients becomes a problem. So a lot of over-the-counters are safe for people in sort of the normal adult age range, again, 18 to 64. But once you get a little older, some of these over-the-counters aren't quite as safe as they were when you were younger.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because I do have a lot of patients who are over 65 who are looking for a safe, pill or some way to help them sleep. And, you know, this does come up a lot because, you know, we call it the Beers criteria, but really the short version is that there are medications on this list that after age of 65 can cause like confusion and person gets up in the middle of the night, they can have a risk of falls. So a lot of sleep aids fall into that category of unsafe for that very reason. What would you recommend for people who are over 65 as a safe option?
So there aren't a lot of choices. One of the things I do recommend that people give a try to, and again, I don't love doing this on your own. I would always recommend talking to your doctor because you don't want to mask an illness that's causing your insomnia. One of the things I have recommended to my older patients is melatonin. So as you know, many of you may have heard, melatonin is actually a natural compound. Our body makes melatonin in the center of our brain, and our body tends to secrete melatonin right before bedtime. And there's a belief, and there's some evidence to support it, that melatonin kind of helps us get ready for sleep. As we get older, our body does make a little less melatonin than it did when we were younger. And so it might seem like people have theorized that maybe the reason that this sleep becomes more irregular and more disruptive as we get older is the loss of melatonin. And maybe that's true, maybe it's not, no one's sure. But a relatively easy thing to try that is over the counter and relatively safe for insomnia as you get older is melatonin. I recommend if people are gonna try it, they take it at the same time every night. That's really important because again, you're trying to get your body into a rhythm. The dose you should take is between 3 and 5 milligrams, not more. I've seen people on 100 milligrams. Don't do that. 3 to 5 milligrams of melatonin, please. And give it at least 2 weeks to work before you call it a failed experiment. Because again, it requires that your body get into a pattern. And you need to take it at the same time, as I said, every day, even on the weekends, even during the week. Because if you're trying to vary the time, then you're not letting your body get into that rhythm. That's probably the one thing I would say I'm comfortable with people trying on their own. And I don't think there are any chronic side effects with melatonin, at least not that I've seen. The biggest side effect is it just doesn't work in some people. But it's cheap to try. The other thing to note is that melatonin, like many over-the-counter things, is not FDA regulated. And so you want to make sure you're buying it from a reputable source and reputable brand. You can decide if it's CVS or Walgreens or one of the GNC stores are all fine. I don't know that I'd buy it on the internet as aggressively.
Right, no, that's a good thing to note. And I know our time is almost up. I'm going to ask you one other question on this topic of medications and supplements. The quality of the sleep when you take a sleep aid, is it the same in terms of quality as when you naturally sleep? And I see you smile, so you got a good answer, a long answer for this
one. I don't know if it's a good answer. It's an answer. So it is definitely true that pharmacologically, drug-induced sleep is not the same as natural sleep, meaning your body gets different stages of sleep. Many medications may change, for example, the amount of REM sleep that you get from non-REM sleep. We didn't do a deep dive on that. So sleep is definitely not the same from a science-y standpoint. Now, what we don't know, what hasn't been as clearly shown is, does that actually matter? Right? Is the fact that they're getting different stages of sleep for an adult affect the quality of their long-term health? And that's not as clear. Now, I still would encourage your listeners, our listeners, since I'm here too, to, if they're taking medication every night to sleep, talk to your doc. Even if you're like, well, I'm doing okay, there will come a time when that's not gonna work as well for you anymore. And it's a heck of a lot easier to make transitions in what you're doing for sleep when you're younger as opposed to when you're older. So if you are somebody who takes medication every night to sleep and you're like, I'm doing fine, please talk to your doctor or PA or NP, whomever you're seeing in clinic. Please talk to a healthcare professional about that.
What great information. So David, I think we only got to the first bucket of the three common sleep problems that you see, which only speaks to just how complex and how many issues can happen surrounding sleep. We may have to have you come back at some point to talk about the other buckets, but I want to thank you for your time. This has just been such great and useful information. Is there anything you would like to add for our listeners before we go?
I think the most important, that we've already covered them, but let me just reiterate. If you're doing okay, doesn't mean that you shouldn't talk to your doctor about the problem. Again, if you're requiring some over-the-counter medication to do okay, it's worth a conversation. Physicians, PAs, NPs are all really well-trained. They can refer you to specialists if need be, but I don't think that avoiding the conversation is a good idea. Just because you've been doing it for many, many years doesn't mean it's normal. So that's probably the big one.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate everything you shared. You've kind of touched on every myth and misconception that I think I see. So that was great information. Thank you so much.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.